Hello and welcome to the American Security Project's Energy Podcast Series. Today I'm joined by Brian Mars, who's a power market specialist, and Robert Petrosky, who's a nuclear engineer. I am Andrew Holland, ASP's Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Policy. Today we're going to talk about nuclear power. Robert and Brian have written an article recently that will be published soon called Nuclear Power: Between Promises, Breakthroughs, and Ludditism. And they're here to discuss that. So why don't we start with Brian, power market specialist, and tell me how things have changed in the post-Fukushima landscape for nuclear.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Andrew. And we appreciate you guys sponsoring this forum for us to discuss these issues. Post-Fukushima, obviously, we've seen a huge breakdown in any potential investments outside of some very niche opportunities in South Carolina and Georgia for nuclear in the United States. And globally, it's kind of cast a shadow, I think, over the future of nuclear somewhat, at least rhetorically. But I think the good news with nuclear is we haven't stopped innovating and we're moving forward. And yes, Fukushima raises some really legitimate governance and technical concerns about nuclear. But, you know, what we see in the United States underneath all of those valid concerns is kind of this rebirth of nuclear innovation. And I think we should really embrace that. And when you look at small modular reactors and government support and funding that's being pushed through to make sure that, we do have a nuclear plan moving forward, I'd say there's considerable reason for optimism. And just painting nuclear as a white elephant based on older technologies, you know, some of which go back to the 1960s and have advanced somewhat into the 1980s and 90s and somewhat to today, it's just kind of unreasonable. And we wouldn't hold other power technologies to the same standard, either in terms of market design or innovation. So kind of on that note, I definitely want to turn this over to Robert.
Interesting. Robert, can you explain how the nuclear being developed for nuclear power being developed for today and the next generation is different from the Fukushima era or, you know, a lot of the current generation reactors that the U.S. uses to generate electricity today?
Mm-hmm. So just to give a little bit of background, the Sure. reactors at Fukushima were constructed in the late 60s, early 70s. So we've since then, it's been four decades, and as you can imagine, for example, looking at things like cars, technology moves a long way in that span of time. So reactors being designed today, many of them feature what's called passive safety systems. So what that means is the reactor would not need either a source of power or operator action to keep itself cooled to prevent a core meltdown. So,
and that was really the problem with Fukushima, wasn't it? That the diesel backup generators failed.
Exactly. So the problem was that there was no power to the plant after the tsunami took out the backup generators. And as a result, there's no way to keep the core cool. And reactors nowadays, they're being designed such that even if you didn't have power, you could rely on gravity and natural convection to remove decay heat. So you don't have the same kind of vulnerability that Fukushima design had.
So Brian mentioned the reactors being built today in South Carolina and Georgia. Those are being developed with this passive technology?
That's right. That's one of the big – so those are AP1000s being built in Georgia, and one of the big selling points is that you can have this sort of walkaway safety for – in their case, I believe they advertise a period of 3 days. They've got decay heat removal capability.
It's Westinghouse, right? Westinghouse is AP1000. Interesting. So, Brian, why aren't we seeing a widespread uptake of that technology around the United States or even around the world?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I think market fundamentals are difficult for building anything right now in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the chief reasons behind that is the incredibly low price of natural gas compared to historic norms. And, you know, when you look at the forward price curve of natural gas over the next decade, it will remain around the $5 to $5.50 mark. And that's that's extremely competitive for natural gas generators. And it's going to mean that coal and nuclear will struggle to compete. And when I say nuclear in this sense, I mean the old designs. You know, I think there's newer designs that are on the drawing board or maybe beyond that could compete against, you know, $40 to $50 megawatt power. But the way current market dynamics are, it's going to be difficult to get those designs licensed and paid for and through the initial development phase, which is why we need things like, you know, government support and kind of an entrepreneurial approach to thinking about what new nuclear will look like and what it should deliver. But, you know, just to go back to your question, really, you know, kind of the fundamental gist of it, and when you look at the way capacity markets are designed, and what a capacity market is essentially it pays a generator for existing to provide, you know, reliability and power when it's called upon. Those margins are also going down. And so what you're seeing is kind of this wave of retirements. For coal, you've got natural gas capacity market structure issues, and then a wave of environmental regulations that are kind of pushing older coal plants to retire. So you've got about 50 gigawatts of coal plants that will come offline. And nuclear is kind of the next big generation source that's in line for that. You've got a lot of post-Fukushima upgrades for safety that are adding to the capital cost of nuclear plants. Some of the plants are just simply old, and they need to replace routine parts and maintenance, and that's adding to capital costs. And all this is happening when natural gas is changing the surrounding market structure. So, you know, when you look at what's happening in the Northeast, the Vermont Yankee plant just retired. I mean, that removes a significant amount of fuel diversity from the generation mix in an area that's becoming increasingly dependent upon natural gas. So I think we just need to make some governance decisions that will impact markets about what our fuel diversity should be and what are the environmental and cost implications of that.
Interesting. So the closure of Vermont Yankee really wasn't about the longstanding safety concerns, but about markets.
Well, I think that the longstanding safety concerns are legitimate, but I do think that what maybe pushed energy over the edge was when they looked at the long-term view of how much that plant was making. You know, this idea of gross margins, so, you know, how much the plant is making before it has taxes and other things factored into its bottom line. They were just plummeting, and it wasn't just because of the plant safety record. The plant was just becoming systematically less competitive, and I think that when faced between kind of a weak economic plant and the wave of litigation that they may receive, just based on the fact that many want to shut that plant down or are willing to sue it forever, they just kind of threw their hands up and said, enough is enough. But, you know, there's other plants that are under similar pressure. I mean, you look at the Fitzpatrick unit in New York, you look at Indian Point in New York, and they've all got large environmental capex that, you know, for thermal, ejection rules, you know, like they're putting too much heat into the water and killing fish, and so they have to put all these, you know, upgrading systems so they don't do that anymore. And, you know, that's very expensive, and as those plants retire, replacing them with low-carbon options is going to be difficult and potentially expensive, and you're also making the grid potentially more reliant upon natural gas. And so that just raises, again, some governance concerns. How do we want to construct markets to achieve the outcomes that we want in terms of reliability, cost, and environmental performance. And I don't think it's as easy as saying, you know, nuclear is bad or nuclear is good. I think nuclear is a tool in the toolbox, and it's an evolving tool, and that's how we should think about it moving forward.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times here in Washington, there's the debate is often well behind technology or markets, you know, and we tend to debate things like nuclear, natural gas, coal, all of this kind of in a, I think I call it kind of a lagging indicator. We talk about it in the same old talking points that we've always talked about. So the people who were against nuclear 20 years ago are still against nuclear. People who are in favor of environmental regulation are pitted against the coal industry, and so on and so forth. And it's the same talking points, and it's all recycled. What I think is interesting and that gets overlooked sometimes is how changing technology can really kind of change this debate or move, you know, cause a real revolution. I think natural gas is the first part of that. You know, the shale revolution is really upset a lot of people's talking points. I wonder how developing nuclear technology, you know, things like SMRs, you mentioned breeder reactors, thorium, or even fusion going forward, how these will kind of change the debate. You know, Robert, what do you think for the outlook for these new and developing technologies? The idea being that what we have today is not what we're looking for, what we're going to have in the future.
Right. And you mentioned a lot of different kinds of ways technologies are being developed. For example, breeder reactors and fusion, the big appeal in those cases is that they can extend your uranium, or in the case of fusion, it would be deuterium and tritium. They extend your fuel resources to such a degree that you can rely on that energy source for many millennia, and it becomes effectively renewable. So those are kind of long-term energy sustainability kinds of technologies. In the near term, what's exciting that's being pursued are the idea of reactors that can be built more safely due to their simplicity, and then this can yield cost benefits as well. So if we look at sort of these vintage plants from the 60s, they were being built in the U.S. extremely cheaply, something like $1,000 to $2,000 per kilowatt electric if you inflate the cost to today's levels.
Wow.
So the reason plants got more expensive, there are a lot of reasons, including the fact that costs of construction in the U.S. generally went up relative to inflation. But one of the reasons was the plants actually had to get more and more complicated, and for good reason, too, because they had to satisfy Nuclear Regulatory Commission requirements. So the NRC was founded kind of at the same time as the nuclear industry in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So this increase in complexity to yield an adequate level of safety really pushed the cost and construction time up. So there's a lot of interesting work going on about reactors, for example, not using pressurized light water as coolant. That could make that safety picture a lot easier to satisfy and with less complexity and cost. So that's kind of exciting from a near-term competitiveness standpoint.
Now, do you think that this is something that's these technologies, are they being taken up more by other countries, or is this something where the U.S. can lead the way on?
The U.S. does have active projects in universities and national labs. And as you can imagine, the big energy consumers like China and India, they are also forging a path forward as far as innovation goes. But in terms of leading the way, I think the U.S. has a really strong head start because that's where nuclear energy technology was born, and we've had the most different kinds of reactors and experience with them here. So it's something that the U.S. can build on if it chooses to.
Interesting. But we have to have to prove that there's a market for it. We have to prove that, you know, the people will want to build these. Brian, what's your assessment? Do you think that the power markets, the utilities, are going to want to build these next generation of nuclear plants?
Yeah, I think it's a question that's going to be – it's a great question. It's going to be one that will be difficult to answer. I mean, I can say this, that, you know, the announcement, I guess, from the EPA last week involving new source performance standards for coal-fired plants has pretty much set the tone that coal-fired power plants, unless CCS becomes off-the-shelf readily available, are not going to materialize in this country moving forward. And so that leaves natural gas, which if you were to replace all today's existing nuclear plants with even high-efficiency natural gas combined cycle plants, the United States would not be able to achieve its Copenhagen or stated Copenhagen targets of a 17% reduction in GHGs by 2020. Nuclear has a role to play, and I think that utilities, particularly utilities with heavy coal fire generation, are going to be interested in reactor units that they can drop into retired coal facilities, you know, because they already have the high electrical wiring on site. They've already been permitted for electric power generation. Now, obviously, I'm not trying to simplify the complexity around nuclear safety, but what I am trying to say is that there are some synergies there between the shift in some utilities thinking about what their generation mix needs to look like over the next decade and what SMRs can offer. And, you know, for merchant generators and non-regulated generators, it's a long time scale thinking a decade out for an SMR, probably too far out. And a lot of investors will tell you, well, we're happy to be second in line for that.
Interesting.
See how it works for the first guys that buy them. And I don't want to say suckers, because I don't think they're going to be suckers. But, you know, the relationships you see materializing commercially now with the Tennessee Valley Authority, with, I guess, Idaho National Lab, you know, finding a role for SMR deployment with government support and private sector development, you know, that formula has worked well in U.S. energy innovation history, and I think repeating it with SMRs is appropriate, despite what some of the I'd say the detractors would say or cast doubt upon. So, you know, I think we should accelerate this, and if they're proven, and if a lot of the advertised costs come within range, I think companies will buy and build and own and operate, and it'll work.
As you both write in your piece at the end here, carbon is the enemy. You know, and that's climate change means that carbon is the enemy, you say. So, you know, I think that when you're talking nuclear, that's the one thing it's got going for it, or one of the top things it has going for it. So with that, I know you both have to go. So thanks to Robert Petrosky and Brian Mars, and thank you all for listening to the American Security Project podcast.